What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning into this episode of Eyewitness History. I am your host, Josh Cohen. This episode, I have the pleasure of speaking with Sherry Fink. Sherry Fink is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, Emmy-nominated television producer, and the author of the New York Times best-selling nonfiction book, 5 Days at Memorial, Life and Death in a Storm-Ravaged Hospital, about choices made in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. She is a producer of the 5 Days at Memorial limited series on Apple TV+. Fink's work has often explored the impact of crises on healthcare and is informed by her background as an MD and former relief worker in disaster and conflict zones. She also holds a PhD in neuroscience. 5 Days at Memorial, the recipient of 8 book awards, was based on an article investigating patient deaths at Memorial Medical Hospital, co-published by ProPublica and the New York Times Magazine. The article won both a Pulitzer Prize and the National Magazine Award. And now I give you Sherry Fink. Okay, I'm here with Dr. Sherry Fink. Sherry, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no, it's a pleasure. I'm really excited to be speaking with you, Sherry. There's so much I want to discuss with you. I want to discuss your career, certainly. I want to discuss Hurricane Katrina, more precisely its aftermath. And I also want to discuss the resultant miniseries on Apple. But before we do, Sherry, could you please tell our listeners that might not be familiar with you who you are and what you do?
Sure. So I'm Sherry Fink. I trained as a physician, and I have been writing for many years about basically mostly stressful situations in that affect healthcare and medical care, and particularly things like natural disasters. I've also done work in conflict areas and a lot on infectious disease outbreaks, including most recently COVID. And so this miniseries that you talked about, it's a limited TV series on Apple TV Plus called 5 Days at Memorial. And that was based on a nonfiction book that I wrote some years back about Hurricane Katrina and the aftermath in one particular hospital. And it really gets at some larger themes that are relevant today about just, you know, how we make decisions in a crisis and what that can mean for all of us, whether we work in healthcare, whether we are patients when, you know, a crisis occurs, or whether we have loved ones who need help. So that is a little nutshell about me.
Perfect. No, thank you, Sherry. I appreciate it. So one question I'd love to ask you might be slightly self-indulgent, but I would love to know. I'd like to ask you about what the experience of winning a Pulitzer Prize is like. What's the experience like and how was it?
So the Pulitzer was for an article that became the basis of the book, 5 Days at Memorial, which then the limited series on Apple TV Plus that came out this year was based on. So that just, there is a link, a thread there. And that was just, it was unbelievable. I mean, yeah, it's for those of us who work in journalism, that is the recognition that is maybe the most prominent or that most people know about. So of course, there is just so much great work every year. And so there's a lot that is just luck that you just feel incredibly, what's the word? It's sort of unbelievable. And then it's fantastic because it raises the profile of whatever you have written or created that is recognized with that award, of course, gets more attention. And in this case, it was about some failures in emergency response that really, really are like a big issue for our country. So it was great on that level too, just knowing that there would be more focus and attention on these events and, you know, maybe some changes.
Yeah, absolutely, Sherry. Thank you. So yes, what was it that drew you to the story of the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina at Memorial Hospital?
So obviously, like New Orleans, which is one of the obviously one of the cities that was devastated in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, in particular for New Orleans, it was the failure of the levee system that protected the city. And the city is below flood level, but this is just an iconic American city. It's, you know, so beloved. So many people have the experience of visiting, even if you, you know, aren't from there or don't have family from there. So this was just huge. I know a lot of young people now might not have a personal memory of Hurricane Katrina, but it was like really pivotal for our country, because I think a lot of people had assumed that the U.S. was so advanced, had such a great economy, and, you know, if there was ever a big natural disaster, that at least there would be, you know, obviously like a lot of suffering and difficulty due to the hazard itself, the storm in this case. But I think maybe a lot of Americans assumed that there would be a fairly robust response to a massive natural disaster like this, or that our infrastructure would hold up better rather than have the whole, you know, levee system fail. And it was just a big, I hate to use cliches, but wake up call for the country. So of course, as somebody who writes about, you know, healthcare and natural disasters, and I had been an emergency responder myself, actually deployed to New Orleans after Katrina as part of a public health team that worked in some shelters around the city, just outside of the city where people were taken or where they got to. So of course, it was just something that was really important to look at. Like, why did this happen? Why did it get so bad? Why did so many people die and so many things go wrong? And then I heard about this particular hospital. This was on the news, this hospital where so many patients had died, and where very soon after the storm, there were some staff of that hospital who came out and said something happened that shouldn't have happened here, and that there were discussions about literally ending patients' lives, which was just stunning. And I think I had just written a book about a war zone where people were under siege for 3 years in the country, Bosnia Herzegovina. And like, it was a war hospital. They had for a long time no supplies, no resupply. They were just doing, you know, war surgery. But I'd never heard of a case where like the staff of the hospital got so desperate they talked about ending their patients' lives. So this is just getting back to your question of what made me pay attention and want to devote what turned out to be years of my life trying to figure out what actually happened and share that with readers and now with viewers, is that this was just, you know, something really important to look at. What actually happened? Why did it happen? Why did people think this thing happened if it didn't happen? And what can we learn from it? And it turns out patients were injected with drugs, and it turned into a very, you know, high profile legal case with health professionals actually getting arrested and accused by the top law enforcement official of Louisiana of having committed second degree murder or participated in it. So for all these reasons, it felt worthy of looking at.
Yeah. No, thank you, Sherry. It's extraordinary. Wanted to introduce the topic of euthanasia later on. I wasn't quite sure how to do it, so I'm grateful to you for doing it for me. And I'd love for you, Sherry, to maybe take a few minutes and just give our listeners a sense of what the inside of those, what the conditions inside the hospital was like during those 5 days that got to the point where euthanasia was seriously discussed and indeed performed.
Well, and I should say calling it euthanasia is also in a way a making a judgment about what happened. And I'll get into that. But that is, you know, euthanasia has a certain meaning usually in the English language or even in law in some places. So, and, you know, euthanasia tends to mean good death. So, you know, was that what happened here was one question. Obviously, the law enforcement official who had the health professionals arrested argued that it wasn't that, that it was murder, or, you know, maybe euthanasia that can be seen as illegal. So it could be both things. And I should also point out that the health professionals who were accused of this very much argued that that wasn't what they had done. And so I was going to say, you know, actually, that's what the limited series on Apple TV Plus, 5 Days at Memorial, does really, really well, is that it, so much effort was put into trying to put you there as far as is humanly possible when you weren't actually there. And that felt really important to the honesty of telling this story, because we can sort of step back and, you know, say, well, this set of actions may be, unethical in terms of like the ethics of medicine or illegal in terms of current laws. But we also wanted people to, you know, is or isn't, I should say, because you could take both sides of that. But it felt really important to also understand context. And so what happened was that Hurricane Katrina hit. This hospital had a full complement of patients and staff, and they got through the storm, which was really scary. But then the levees failed and the water rose outside of this hospital, and it became very hot because the backup power system did not help the generator. It wasn't connected to the generators. The generator system was not connected to the air conditioning system. This is actually surprisingly true in many American hospitals, that when you go on backup power, it would require quite a, you know, very expensive and big system to keep the HVAC systems, the heating and air conditioning and ventilation systems, going. So oftentimes they aren't supported. So this hospital became like an oven, and then the water started rising, and the staff had, you know, known that when the water got to a certain level, all power would go out. Like even that backup generator system that was keeping, you know, the medical record system and all of the machines that the patients needed going was going to go out. And so they knew that they had to evacuate this hospital. But wouldn't you know it, for all the emergency plans that they had, there was no planning for this scenario of evacuating a hospital when the surrounding city is flooded. And so the series really puts you, you know, into that as a viewer, and you walk along with these, you know, this dramatic interpretation of the actual story. And you see conditions getting worse and worse. You see some patients starting to decline in the heat, or because they're moved toward a helipad where they might not have their, you know, normal healthcare providers around them to know what kind of care they need. And then this long wait as you realize that the whole city is flooded, that there is a need for rescue of people off of rooftops, that multiple hospitals need to be evacuated, and the rescue doesn't come quickly enough, and the communications with the outside world, you know, sort of diminish, and the staff, you know, become very confused about when and if the rescue will arrive. And so that is the context. It's amazing. Like in real life, I think the timeline is a little bit shifted in the series from what it was in real life. But in real life, the storm hit on a Monday morning. The water rose on a Tuesday. The power went out early Wednesday morning. And then this decision was made just one day later.
That's incredible. Incredible. Sherry, I'd love to know, who was Emmett Everett?
So Emmett Everett is a real gentleman, by all accounts, just a, you know, like a great guy. And he had a family who really loved him. I'm speaking in the past tense here. He was one of the patients, you know, at this hospital. And he had many medical problems. He'd had something that is kind of rare, but as a young man, he'd had a spinal cord stroke. So that left him unable to walk. And then he also was obese and had other medical issues. He was waiting for a surgery at this hospital, and then was on the seventh floor of a hospital that suddenly didn't have working elevators. And he was morbidly obese. And it's so outrageous to think about this. You know, like it actually, as the series came out, and I've been, you know, you mentioned the Pulitzer was quite a number of years ago, but just getting a chance to think about this story in the current context after we've all gone through a pandemic has been interesting to revisit it. And one of the things that's really struck me about his case is that there were these discussions that started about, well, how can we rescue him? He weighs, I don't remember how much he weighed exactly, but, you know, morbidly obese and not able to walk down the stairs. And, you know, that this was considered a huge problem, was like how to get him down the stairs and then up to this helipad, which was on the top of the adjoining parking garage. So like down 7 flights of stairs or 6, and then up 8 flights where they could drive him up to the top of this parking garage, and then have to like carry him up a staircase. And, you know, there was like no equipment apparently to help with this, and no people were just... One of the dangers, I think, in an emergency is your scope of vision can kind of narrow, and you just can feel very, when you don't have the usual tools that you're used to, like, how can we possibly do this? And according to the people who discussed his case, like, they basically thought that they couldn't get him out. And, you know, he was one of more than nearly two dozen patients who were found after this disaster with morphine, Versed, or both drugs in their bodies. And they had died in a very short time period on that last day. And he had been injected with these drugs. And, you know, there is a counterfactual, which is that there were other places, and even at this hospital, where people of a similar size who couldn't walk were successfully gotten out of these hospitals and taken to, you know, other hospitals. But in his case, he wasn't given that chance. And so his case, you know, like, he lived at home, his family, you know, like, felt very much that he should have had been given more of a chance to survive. His direct providers felt like he wasn't in danger of dying. So why was he injected with these drugs? And, you know, what can possibly, for all of us to think about, like, how can we prevent such a, you know, needless deaths in the future?
Yeah, absolutely, Sharon. That actually leads me into my next question. So, you know, at a certain point, the workers at Memorial Hospital, you know, would have felt abandoned by the outside world, in effect. And no doubt that contributed to the mass panic. And I'm keying off your last sentence. I'd like to know if you think this feeling could have been prevented in any way.
The feeling that they had, you said, of being abandoned? Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. I think that people who I interviewed, and I should say, you know, the process of research for the article, then for the book, and then even continued for the limited series was very extensive. So I spoke with, you know, many, many people and who were actually there. I wasn't, but spent years trying to piece this together, you know, through records, through interviews, through everything that I could possibly find, weather reports, you name it. And so many of the people I interviewed did have this sense of being abandoned, even though, you know, sort of like one of the tragic aspects of this was just as those injections of those patients was taking place, finally, you know, helicopters were focusing on getting patients out of this hospital. There was a private corporation that owned it, and they sent their own helicopters, but belatedly, they didn't do that right away. They thought they could rely on the government to execute a rescue, and finally realized that wouldn't be sufficient. So just at the moment that the desperation got that bad, in fact, the resources to evacuate patients expanded. And so that's something I think, you know, everybody who works in a crisis needs to maybe keep in mind, because it's not just Katrina, but many different crises, is that resources can change, and that sometimes, you know, thinking creatively and trying to really get more resources can solve and avoid some of the most tragic types of decisions. And we saw that a lot with the COVID pandemic, where we maybe thought we would have to ration ventilators, for example, or, you know, where things got very tight, or even there was prioritization or rationing in some cases, but also creative thinking and sharing and load leveling and just different strategies can avoid some of these problems, not all the time, but sometimes. So I think in answer to your question, you know, better preparedness, better mechanisms of communication in disasters, because there was a total communication failure because people's phones stopped working, emails stopped working, et cetera. And there's been, you know, some work on hardening our communications infrastructure, but not enough, so that it doesn't go down at the very moment that it's really, really needed. And just a lot of preparedness in advance, and a lot of also flexible thinking and being able to pivot when, as always, the plans don't meet with reality. So both of those things, I think, are super important. And it's even maybe a psychological mindset issue, too, because that feeling of desperation is very normal. These were health providers who worked in, you know, America, in a quite, you know, well-regarded community, privately owned hospital. And so they really weren't used to this idea of suddenly dealing with such a monumental loss of the tools that they rely on to save lives. And I think it's normal that a lot of people felt desperate in those circumstances, but that's where preparation comes in, you know, running drills and getting people used to the idea that even in a crisis like this, you can still do some good and that it will eventually end and that, you know, there are ways to get through it. And that comes to like leadership, I think, is a huge piece of this. There were a lot of hospitals that were in a similar situation of losing power and waiting days for rescue, which is not good. But even within that, there were some hospitals where internal communications were better, where like staff knew that they were going to be briefed every 6 hours with the best that the leadership knew at that time. So they would all, you know, come to a central place and get a briefing. Whereas at this hospital, people would say, you know, I thought it was supposed to be at 7 o'clock and I come and it had happened at 6 o'clock. So there were rumors and confusion and a sense of like confusion about who was in charge. So I think, you know, those people who might be listening who are leaders in their various fields or who, you know, you have young people who listen, if you become a leader, that's really important, is to think about the mindset of your staff. And we look at after COVID, this is super important in our healthcare industry. And there is a lot of mental stress and a lot of desperation, I think, even over just work conditions and various aspects of working in healthcare in a stressful time. We're now, as you and I are talking, many hospitals in the U.S. are facing quite a surge of respiratory illnesses and some shortages in medications. And so these issues aren't, I think the use of like watching 5 days at Memorial or reading the book is like, you look at this very, very extreme or notable example of a disaster in our history, but there are so many, you know, whether it's like a winter storm or, you know, infectious disease outbreak or a pandemic or whatever, like there's so many ways that our systems can be stressed or that we might find ourselves temporarily in a situation that could have a lot of life and death consequences. And so this is why it's like really useful to look at our history and learn from it. And that part of it is that mental preparation that you asked about, so that people don't feel like, oh my God, I'm the only person who's ever faced this and it's desperate and I have to just, you know, give up or make tragic decisions. Like, I think we can get that fortitude a little more just from learning from the past, and then also, you know, being kind with ourselves and others and knowing that there's no perfect decision sometimes and that it's a lot of very difficult choices and you have to be kind to yourself that you did the best you could. That's also a piece of this.
Yeah, no, that's well said, Sherry. I appreciate it. There was one question I wanted to ask you. It's at the front of my mind just because it was an interview that I did recently. So I recently interviewed a man named Charles Stanley Jr., who helped direct the state's response to 9/11 under George Pataki. The reason I want to pull him in here is because I want to ask you from an infrastructure and response standpoint, I'm just curious if you see any sort of contrast or comparison between the 9/11 attacks and Katrina that you might like to talk about.
There's a lot of relevance there. I mean, obviously in 9/11, the healthcare institutions in New York City were just waiting to treat patients. And the horrific result of that attack was that there weren't living people to treat. So it was a different kind of emergency. However, one of the interesting impacts that it had, so that was, of course, in 2001, Katrina was 2005, so a few years later. And one of the interesting things that happened is that we always seem to be, well, in some cases, sort of like, maybe learning from the past disaster, or we may have a little bit of a spurt of more attention on preparing or preparedness and a little bit of money that becomes available to harden our, you know, like emergency response systems, which always seem to be somewhat like underfunded or there's less of a focus on them in normal times because of all our other priorities. And so one of the results of that was that because of the anthrax attacks that followed that, people might remember there were these mailing these envelopes with white powder. And so tied into the, you know, like big changes in our national response, we had like the Department of Homeland Security was created after 9/11. And a lot of, there was also like a lot of focus on the prospect of bioterrorism as well. And so interestingly, the hospital in New Orleans, which when you think about like, what are the likeliest hazards? That's always like a really important when you're thinking about preparing for disasters, and you may have limited funds to prepare for them. Like, what are the things that are pretty foreseeable? And a hurricane in New Orleans would be, I would argue, because it, you know, plenty of times coastal storms are hitting that area of the country, would be one that you would want to expend a lot of focus on preparing for that. But because of those post 9/11 funds and the focus on bioterrorism, interestingly, the hospital had a 101-page bioterrorism preparedness plan. I want to say 101 pages. It might have been 110. I can't exactly remember. But the, you know, the number of pages in their book for hurricanes was just a few pages. So I just thought that was quite interesting, like where do the priorities go? Sometimes it's fighting the last battle. And then sometimes we just turn away and stop focusing on preparedness after the big disaster passes. And that's a danger right now with COVID. I think, you know, a lot of people want to move on, but there's a huge possibility that there will be, you know, another pandemic, another outbreak that we need to prepare for on lots of levels as a country. And we've seen all the ways we weren't prepared. And, you know, like more than a million people just in the US died of COVID. So I think, yeah, it's just, this highlights for us. So there are those links with 9/11, certainly. And it was 9/11 was a key moment in the history of the preparedness sort of field in the US for sure. And so Katrina was another big step in that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Sherry, I may have already asked this, but let me go ahead and ask it outright. I am curious how it is that the book came to be the basis for the Apple miniseries that we've already kind of discussed, 5 Days at Memorial. How did that come about?
So thank you for asking that. And I should say it's on Apple TV Plus, which for people who don't know, you can sign up, like you can watch on any device and get a free trial and try it out. It's not the same as like a device. It can be watched on any device and streamed online. And so I think when the book came out, there was interest in amongst the people who know how to make movies and TV shows, which is not me, in translating the book into something for the screen. And I was very much in support of that because I feel like, you know, a lot of people like to watch really good TV or really good movies and might not necessarily read a book. And then there are other people who really love reading books. So it seemed like a chance to have also just, I truly believe that the medium also matters. Not the first person to say that. So this discussion that we're having using audio, you know, audio, I think, is like very intimate. And, you know, all the people listening to us, we're just having a conversation. There's some great aspects of that and ways that information passes or stories can be told. So I really appreciate the fact that there are these different ways to tell stories. And truly, truly, when you watch the series, there is something, I think, different that comes through than when you read. And when you read, you're going to get a lot more information on like what actually happened because it's a nonfiction book. So I was excited about the idea of like viewers getting to actually, you know, like watch a recreation of this event. And Apple TV Plus, so Carlton Cuse and John Ridley were the executive producers. They also directed most of the episodes with Wendy Stansler being a third director. And they also wrote all the episodes, which I think is rare. And so they just had this dedication to the story, to the subject matter, to respecting all the people who walked through this, whether they were healthcare providers or patients or family members, and then just got an incredible group of actors and, you know, set designers and people who do all the special effects and people who make the props. And it's just, I mean, I'm going into all that detail because for me, as someone who's worked as a journalist and author, it was a new world to see how many brilliant people have to come together to make this kind of like high quality television. And Apple TV, you know, supported this, Apple TV Plus. They supported this just, you know, to an extent where it could be created with such respect and detail and, you know, commitment to that kind of that level of authenticity, even though it is a dramatic translation of the actual or adaptation of the actual events. So it's not, you know, it's not nonfiction, it's fictionalized, but it's deeply respectful and, you know, really does get the story across in a very, very, very powerful way. And, you know, of course I'm biased, but I thought they did a fantastic job. And that is just another element. And it's nice, like people will read the book and watch the series. And I just spoke to like a whole university program that they assigned both the book and the series to the students. And just to hear them talk and ask questions about that adaptation process was really cool. So that's how it came about. Just, you know, there was like real interest in making it. And it took a few tries, as it often does. And finally found the proper home with Apple TV Plus and these brilliant people who acted and served all of these roles, directed, etc. I wish I could mention all of them because I have so much respect for all of them and the acting is just incredible.
Yeah, well, I can say this. I watched it myself in preparation for this interview and I loved it. I would encourage all of our listeners to check it out. Well, excellent. Dr. Sherry Fink, how can people find out about you?
How they could find out about me? I guess mostly through my work, but I do have a website, you know, old school, sherryfink.net, Sherry with one R. And, you know, they can watch the series, they can read the book. And I'm currently working on a book about the COVID pandemic. So hopefully in sometime in the future, they can read that.
Excellent. Excellent. Sherry, thank you so much for taking time for me today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks so much for your interest and for focusing on these issues of emergency response and preparedness in your podcast.
Oh, that's my pleasure, Sherry. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode. For more information on eyewitness history, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen, and James Early's Key Battles of American History, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.